Welcome to Making Sense, supported by KiwiBank. I'm Frances Cook, an independent financial journalist of many years, best-selling author, and financial freedom seeker who makes money simple for you. There are lots of issues that can hold people back from learning about their money. One of them is just feeling it could all be a bit complicated and hard. So add in a layer of religion and what works and doesn't work for your faith, and you have a recipe for people getting confused and just giving up. Enter Mohammed Lambert from Muslim Investing. Now, he has dedicated himself to figuring out halal investing, what that means, from whether you can get a mortgage to when crypto is okay or not. There are also lots of gray areas where even people in the know disagree. So let's jump in to figure it out. I'm joined now by Mohammed Lambert, content creator and founder of Muslim Investing. Now, as I just introed you there, you run this really popular account and frankly, really interesting account, Muslim Investing. I love following you. I learn something new every time. I just want to be super clear from the beginning that I'm really far from an expert in this area. I'm sure I'll learn new things in this conversation too, which frankly, I'm excited for. I think that's always a fun way to start a conversation. But it is going to be an area where I only know a little bit, enough to hopefully ask you interesting questions. So let's start at the very beginning. What makes investing different as a Muslim person?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. First, thank you for having me on. When it comes to Muslim investing, like halal investing for Muslims, it's largely down to the Islamic finance principles. So as long as it fits in line with that. So what those are, the big one is we don't deal with interest. No interest in terms of paying interest, receiving interest. That's a big no-no in terms of Islamic finance. Another one is we try not to get ourselves involved with excessive risk. So excessively risky investments, also avoiding uncertainty. So I mentioned no interest. A big focus, what we focus on when it comes to risk is profit, loss, risk sharing between both parties of an investment. And it's largely community centered when it comes to the kind of investments we involve ourselves with. We try and like benefit the community at large as opposed to sort of just looking out for ourselves when it comes to investing. I think those are big differences. Also conventional investing, I would say the main goal of investing is to maximize returns. Whereas for us, it's to keep it in line with our faith and having an ethical form of investing. I think those would be the big differences between halal investing versus conventional investing.
And how much does this get talked about by the Muslim community? And how much is this something that people worry about? You know, I think what I'm trying to ask is it a really sort of central idea, or is it one of those things that can be sort of buried within religious texts? You know, how big an issue is this for people?
Yeah, that is actually a great question. So I mentioned no interest. I think that's probably the one which most people already know. It's all the other ones where people are sort of not completely sure what is halal investing. It is talked about, probably not as much as I'd like, hence the reason we've got Muslim Investing. But over the past couple of years, over the past like 5-6 years, the Islamic finance industry has really grown. I think there's been a lot more education in the space.
Yeah. And I think it's interesting, isn't it? Because it adds another layer on top of what can be already tricky. I mean, there are lots of barriers in the way of people feeling confident with their money, feeling good with their money. And then you've got these specific ones that come up for people who are Muslim and who their faith is important to them. So do these issues create barriers to people doing well with their money, do you think?
I think so. So a big misconception that I find, at least in our community, is that people think they can't be a good or religious Muslim and be wealthy because, you know, money is the root of all evil. Whereas the reality is they're just not sure how to navigate the finance world. They're not sure what is permissible to invest in. They're not sure what they have to avoid. A lot of the time you have people avoiding investing at large just because they're not sure. And they just think, and they assume the entire industry is just not okay to invest in. Or you have people who are, you know, unknowingly investing in things which they probably shouldn't. That's what I find as a misconceptions, definitely.
Okay, so let's dive into the issue of
interest, because I feel like almost all of the money world is based on some level of interest. That must make things quite tricky. What sort of things quickly become an issue there? Is there a reason why that's seen as an issue?
Yeah, I mean, with interest, I think the big issue with interest is it by nature, well, the way we look at it anyway, it's an exploitative sort of relationship between borrower and lender, where one side's benefiting over the other at the cost of the other. And there's sort of an unequal balance between the borrower and the lender. Hence, you know, we encourage profit loss risk sharing. So when we look at investments, both parties are going in equally. Both are at risk of, you know, making money. Both are at risk of losing money, just in the same way. Also, in terms of a productive use of wealth, interest isn't super productive in that way. It's like sort of a guaranteed return. If you're looking at a conventional savings account, for example, you put your money in, it's pretty much, you know, guaranteed that you're going to get that interest, as small or as high as it may be. Whereas it's not super productive in the way it's used. You have no say in what's happening with that money. You know, the bank, you know, uses it however they use it. They make their money, they give you their very, very small cut. Whereas with investing, there's a lot more like productive use of your wealth. We encourage asset-backed investments as opposed to interest-based, where there's not really any say about what's happening. There's not really a productive use in the way it's used. We look at money just as a tool, and investments are a way to sort of grow that wealth as opposed to interest, where you're not really doing anything with it like yourself.
That's super interesting. So that must come into, you know, even things like the sort of lower risk investments like bonds would be an issue. Yeah. Is there such a thing as halal bonds, or is that something that's just out of the...
We have, they're called sukuk. So they're an Islamic alternative to bonds.
Okay.
So they work in a similar way in terms of what they're used for. However, how they work are, so bonds are, if I'm correct, you lend money and then you receive interest payments over like 30 years or however long the term is. Whereas with sukuk, you are going in as an investor with the organization and you receive profit payments from whatever's being invested in. So they're asset backed as opposed to interest based. They have expected returns, as you know, it's longer, lower risk sort of investment, but not guaranteed. And that's with any sort of halal investment. Even when you see percentage returns and things like that, it's always an expected return as opposed to a guaranteed return. And obviously, based on research, and you know, banks have been around for a while, so they can sort of predict what that expected return will look like. However, at the end of the day, it's not guaranteed.
Okay. What about things like, you know, you mentioned there about banks and banking. Lots of people would be looking to buy a first home or maybe an investment property, and a lot of mortgages based on the idea of interest. Does it make it tricky with property?
Absolutely. So in a place like New Zealand, we have basically near to zero Islamic mortgage options. So it makes it very difficult for Muslims to buy a property in New Zealand anyway. And it's a similar case across the world. There are Islamic mortgage options in certain parts of the world. Again, very different in terms of how they operate. They look very similar, and that's another, like people are not 100% sure whether they're okay to invest in, because from the outside, they look very similar in that you're going in with another party, buying a property, and then, you know, you're eventually paying more over time. So it can make it difficult for Muslims to invest in property in a place like New Zealand. However, there are alternatives like property crowdfunding websites where you can get access to the property market without having all the capital up front. So you pool money with, you know, maybe, you know, 1,000 other investors, buy a property and you receive rental payments. So you can get access to the property market. You just can't necessarily buy a property yourself. So the alternative is to rent. That is, you know, definitely an option, which I think is pretty like doable in New Zealand in terms of renting. Isn't super hard to get, you know, to rent a property. But I have heard cases where in other parts of the world, it can be very competitive, very, very expensive compared to buying a property to rent. So it varies. It does make it difficult, but there are other ways around it. Investing in the stock market, investing in other assets, if you just want to grow your wealth and then, you know, rent the property you live in.
Talk to me more about this crowdfunding option. That's really interesting. So here in New Zealand, they have websites where you can crowdfund your way into a property. So is that like you would put a little bit in and you get a little splice of ownership, or are you asking other people to chip in for a home for you? How's that working?
So there is on a small scale in New Zealand, but more I was more talking about abroad, but you can access it being in New Zealand. But yeah, how it works is, yeah, you pull money, say you're putting $1,000 and you've got 1,000, 10,000 other people, you all go together and buy a property. One of those parties, they'll likely have more shares of the property, will be living in that property, and they'll be paying rent to essentially all the other investors. And then each investor receives a portion of that rent. And, you know, there's different terms for how long that is. And that's sort of how that works. So you can access the property market. Property will increase over time. Eventually, when they sell it, you'll then also receive a portion of the capital gains.
And you mentioned there about, you know, looking for Islamic mortgage options. What are the options there? You know, can you, what would an Islamic mortgage even look like for starters? And then can you access it within New Zealand or from overseas, or how does that work?
Yeah, that's a great question. So an Islamic mortgage, how it works is, so that we've got an Islamic finance institution and yourself, you go in together, say you're putting 20%, they're putting 80%, you go in together and buy the property. And then over time, you're buying the shares of the Islamic finance institution. Plus, you'd be paying like rent in addition to whatever the market price is over the, say, 30 years. And over 30 years, you're buying a bit of their, you're buying back the 80% off them. So over 30 years, eventually you'll have your 100% back. That's one of the ways it's done. There are different ways. There are other ones where the bank buys the property for you and they sell it back to you in installments at a higher price. Again, over a 30-year period. So that's where people are like, it looks very, very similar to a conventional bank in that, you know, you're going to be paying more over 30 years, for example. However, the way it's structured is different. There's no interest payments. They're making a profit. However, you're not paying interest on the actual property. Because they're not loaning you the money, they're buying the property as opposed to lending you the money. I think that's a big difference between a conventional mortgage and an Islamic mortgage.
It's fascinating stuff. So if someone is, we'll stick with the New Zealand example. I know we have listeners who are based elsewhere, but it just keeps us in the wheelhouse of what's known. If someone is in New Zealand and their Muslim faith is important to them and they're wanting to, let's say, buy a first home, are they sort of at the moment a little bit stuck with a bit of a decision between their faith and that first home, or are they able to make this happen? It's just a little more complicated.
Yeah, I mean, like I mentioned, there are two smaller organizations that sort of facilitate this, but it's more of a, if you're in on the like organization, then you're kind of involved. Otherwise, it's a bit more difficult to get access to that. So it can be, yeah, either you rent or you go ahead and take a conventional one. There is an opinion within the, you know, the Islamic religion that says you can take a conventional mortgage out for your first home if there is no other option. I personally don't agree with it because I don't feel a property is, in terms of buying a property, is a right in terms of an essential, so long as you can rent. Difficult for, like, if you're looking at generic wealth building, and that opinion might not be there, but personally, I would be more comfortable renting just because I feel going with a conventional mortgage would be against what I sort of believe in. But yeah, a lot of people are stuck with that decision of deciding whether they want to rent or go for a conventional mortgage, especially when an Islamic mortgage isn't available here, like wide, you know, for the masses.
Mm. That kind of brings up something that has been on my mind a little bit as well in the lead up to this conversation, because you do amazing work talking about this online, and I know you talk about it elsewhere too. You are, you know, trying to bring awareness to these issues for people both inside and outside of the Muslim community of what's going on here and what the options are, and it's fantastic. But of course, it's a huge religion. I'm sure there are lots of people with different perspectives on these things. They would have different sort of red lines on where they draw the line. Is it tricky when you are talking about these issues very publicly and sometimes being held up as, here is the Muslim point of view, where I'm sure it's not a monolith, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, yeah. Like, even like if you look at stocks, for example, when it comes to like, what is a halal stock or what is a permissible stock to invest in, there are, because if we look back in like history, there wasn't stocks and shares like there is today. So there wasn't, like, in our scriptures, in the Quran, there isn't specific guidelines on how to invest in the stock market, because obviously the stock market didn't exist, you know, 1400 years ago. Over the years, Islamic finance scholars have come up with a set of criteria to determine what makes an investment halal. However, there are different scholars and they didn't necessarily have them all. They didn't agree exactly in the same way. So they'll have slight variations. So the scholars didn't agree when it comes to like modern day investments. Even more so with people today. So when it comes to halal investments, we have the two types of screen. We've got the business screen. So we look at the business activities of the company, and then we'll avoid industries that are not permissible in Islam. So things like alcohol, tobacco, weapons, those sort of industries. Those are companies, if that is largely their core business, we won't be investing in those companies. And then you've got the financial criteria side of things. So scholars have said that it's difficult to have a company that is earning zero interest. For example, you can have a large company like Apple. Their core business might be not an issue. However, they may have a portion of their wealth in a bank and savings account earning interest. So they've essentially given a tolerance of up to 5% of where the revenue can be impermissible, just to allow us, as saying basically most of their revenue, 95% or more of their revenue is permissible to invest in. And that would make that stock halal to invest in. And another criteria is that the total debt of the company is less than 30%. However, when I was talking about differences in like variation, like one criteria will say 30%, one will say 33%. So there's like slight variations, but as a whole, it's very similar in that roughly one third of a company's debt will be less than 30% the debt of the company. And that's sort of how we look at it in terms of difference in variation.
Yeah, and it's funny, isn't it? Because you can get really caught out on that when people are looking at ethical investing options for all sorts of different criteria. I mean, Boeing is one that comes up all the time. They make planes. They are a huge company. They also make weapons. And I wouldn't even know what percentage of the company that is. But there have been a lot of people that have been quite surprised to find out that if you're investing in Boeing, you're investing in weapons. That's just one of those things. And so you've got these criteria of, we have these ideals and we don't want these companies getting into more than a certain percentage of that, which makes a lot of sense, but tricky. So are there things like ETFs or funds that make this a little bit easier for people? Surely there must be quite a big market for this.
For sure. So, I mean, even on the criteria itself, because like, the reality is the average investor is not going to go check up the financial, you know, reports and be like, okay, cool, it's 5%, 4%. How do I manage that? You have halal stock screening apps that filter those out. So you can search up literally a stock and it'll tell you whether or not it passes compliance. But yeah, like you mentioned, ETFs. So we have a bunch of ETFs. So like there are a few big ones. So we look at the S&P 500 and we're like, there's 500 companies there. Let's strip out all the ones that aren't permissible to invest in. And then you've got around 200 and something companies left. And that's one example is the SPUS ETF, which is essentially the S&P 500, but the halal version, for example. And Muslims can invest in that. So they access the same similar markets, similar types of investments, similar industries, just the compliant version. Basically, that's sort of what we have as well when it comes to investing. What that means is there are much less ETFs to invest in. However, there are a variation now. And I think more and more are popping up over the years, especially since I started out in Islamic finance, there wasn't anything available. And now there are. Before, we'd just be investing in individual stocks, which is not cost effective if you're trying to invest in a diverse array of assets.
Yeah. You mentioned apps there as well. I know that people love a little digital helper there. Do you have any apps that you particularly recommend?
Yeah. So on halal stock screening, there is Muslim Exchange. And we've got Zoya. So they allow you to screen stocks in various stock markets. And if you're interested in crypto, there's an app called Saraf, which allows you to screen the crypto market. In terms of investment platforms, you can use any of the platforms that are available in New Zealand, whether it's Sharesies, Hatch, Stake, it doesn't really matter. You can combine that with a stock screener and it allows you to invest in the stock markets just so you can pick which stocks are halal by using these apps, and you can use a regular broker. But you've also got halal robo advisors. A good example is Wahid, where the entire platform's, you know, halal to invest in, and all you have to do is sort of set it up and then they manage the investments for you.
you mentioned crypto there, and that has sparked something for me because that was one of my big questions when I was doing a bit of research pre this chat, and I read, okay, you know, excessive risk, not great. And my immediate thought was, does that mean things like crypto are out? Because that goes up and down and up and down, huge swings. Where does that leave investments like that?
So stocks are pretty straightforward because we've got like clear cut criteria that have been around for a while. Crypto obviously is a lot more riskier as an investment. So there are differences of opinions when it comes to crypto. We've got one side that says basically all of it is impermissible. It's super risky. Like, it's just crazy. Like, you can't manage your investments, none of that. So therefore, you can't invest it. The other one says, if there is real world utility with the token, if there's no interest involved, if what they're using the crypto for isn't like against our faith, then it can be permissible to invest in because it's saying there's real world use case. So therefore, it's probably not as risky. It may fluctuate in price. However, there's a real like use for it. It's not, you know, just for fun. So, you know, in saying that, things like meme coins are not an investment that is permissible. I mean, even from just, I think a normal investment point of view, I wouldn't recommend meme coins to anyone per se.
Yeah, no Hawk coin for you.
It's interesting because obviously we see some of these investments and I'm like, well, if only I had put my money in that. And then at the end, it's reassuring to know that I can't invest in it anyway. And I'm glad I did. And if it's trending, it's probably not the right time to invest in it anyway, because then you probably miss the boat.
That is great advice for just about every area of money. If you are hearing everyone talking about it and there's a whole bunch of hype, probably just don't right now. What's the old fear and greed index? If the button is pushing on the greed, just avoid. So could that mean that things like maybe the more mainstream coins, things like Bitcoin, maybe even Ethereum, that could fit the criteria according to, you know, as we've said, this is a bit of a gray zone, but that could fit the criteria for some people. But yeah, meme coins, no.
Yeah, exactly. So like you can use that app I mentioned, Saraf, that's S-A-R-A-F, and it'll tell you like what's okay to invest in and why. So it has like a report that runs through. So yeah, things like Bitcoin, Ethereum are fine to invest in if you're of that opinion, I suppose. I don't typically, like when I'm talking to people about investments, it's not like, if they've never invested, I'm not like, hey, you should get into Bitcoin. It's more like, do your research. And that's the same with any investment before you get involved. Probably start with stocks, you know, as a form of easier investment to understand, unless you are in the blockchain space. But it just depends. And with any investment, always do your research.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely, absolutely. It so often does come back to some of those fundamentals, right? I mean, We've touched on this a little bit, but let's dive into it a bit more. Some of the gray areas, I mean, there are places where people disagree with each other all over the personal finance community. I'm sure that once you add religion into the mix, there would be even more potential for disagreement. So what are some of the main gray areas that you see pop up where there can be disagreement over what people believe could be acceptable and what isn't?
Yeah, so we've obviously mentioned crypto, Islamic mortgages are another one. I think another one is Forex. People differ on whether that's okay or not okay to invest in. With you know, halal investing, a lot of it is when it's done, it should be done in spot trades. And I think that's where Forex is a big issue, in that there's trading settlement days, there's leverage involved, there's a whole bunch of other factors. And you have platforms that sort of mitigate that and allow you to invest without interest. However, personally, I'm not sort of happy with those. And that's where you have a difference of opinion, where some say it's okay to invest in Forex, some say it's not. I think increasingly recently, it's been not like that's been the more popular note. You know, even though there have been platforms that sort of facilitate non-interest based Forex trading, there are still problems with Forex. And if you're looking at just Forex as a form of investment, very, very few people make money with it. And the ones that do are leverage trading, because you're making like very minimal percentage points, but you need to have like hundreds of thousands in order to make wealth. That's definitely an area where I have a lot of conversation with people and I'm like, why Forex? Why not other investments? And I also encourage longer term investing as opposed to short term investing. And I think trading is another one in general that people, there's a gray area, because when it comes to the criteria and things like that, we're looking at due diligence with investments, researching investments. But if you're day trading, how do you do that? How do you manage all those different compliance factors when you're buying and selling stocks, like on the daily or hourly in some cases? How do you do that? And that's another gray area where some say it's halal, some say it isn't. I personally just stay away from day trading in general. I'm more of a long-term investor, but that is definitely a gray area for people.
We've talked a lot about some of the tricky parts. And I think there's always a risk when we have these conversations that it becomes not quite negative, but like almost too negative. So I'd love to chat about, what do you think are some of the strengths of investing in a halal way?
Yeah, I mean, I would say typically because we look at lower debt, right? So the companies that we invest in are, a lot of the time I would say, have stronger fundamentals than just companies that have higher interest, have more debt as a form of investment. They're also more ethically inclined. Not entirely the same as ESG investing, but there are certain factors that are similar and overlap. The ultimate goal with halal investing is to provide a betterment for the community, to benefit the people. So if you're investing in line with that, it can be beneficial to invest in those companies. And they typically do better long-term. I think I was looking at some research, don't quote me on this, but they were looking at during COVID and the investments that performed. They compared, like I mentioned earlier, the SPUS, so the Sharia compliant version of the S&P 500 versus the S&P 500 and just conventional investments. And the ones that were Sharia compliant performed better over times of recession and things like that, because they held up and withstood harsher conditions because they weren't taking on as much debt. And I would believe that. Obviously, you can probably look at it, and if anyone wants to look at this and check it themselves, but I think the halal investing companies perform better long term. And obviously, we say halal investing companies, you're thinking Muslim companies, but the reality is it just means they meet Sharia compliance. And these are normal companies like Apple, Microsoft. They're not Muslim owned companies per se. They're not selling anything Muslimy necessarily. They're just compliant with the criteria that we've set out. So they're normal large companies a lot of the time.
It strikes me as I obviously have the ethical investing conversation with people a lot. And one thing that comes up constantly is people say, how do I choose between making more money and investing ethically? And I totally get where that comes from, because obviously the reason any of us invest is to have financial stability. No one ever has to apologize to me for wanting to be financially secure. It's totally natural and normal. But I feel like the idea that it is a choice between the two is a bit of a false sort of premise, where actually there's so much research that's come out now that ethically investing can make you more money even. One of the things I've talked about with people is that you often find these less ethical companies are in sunset industries. They're in industries where it's going to run out of road at some point, where either there's going to be backlash from customers, there's going to be backlash from governments, they're going to face more regulation, or they're in a non-renewable resource area and they're going to run out of the resource. You know, there's so many reasons that these unethically based companies can face issues. And yet the ethical way of operating often ends up being the more long-term sustainable way of operating. It might make less money in the first 2 years, but after 10, they often do really, really well. And it strikes me that that is also something that's coming up when you're looking at investing from the Muslim point of view, when you're looking at investing in the halal way. Is that something that you're seeing too?
Exactly. Exactly. I think a lot of people, it's the get rich quick scheme sort of mindset where everyone wants to make money really, really quickly. But if you just hold out for a little bit and also keep it within whatever your ethical parameters are, you'll likely find that your investments will do better long term. And that's a similar mindset with the Muslim community. And that's sort of what I'm encouraging and what I'm sort of educating people, that you can invest, you can be a good Muslim and you can be rich. They're not like two separate things. And that is a massive misconception that's in the community.
Yeah. And I do think that's something that people come at it from different angles, right? But it is a mindset that comes up over and over again of, if you are interested in money and you are interested in being financially stable, that means that you are greedy or unethical or whatever. And it can lead to that. I mean, I'm not naive. There are certainly heaps of people who chase money over all else. And I don't think that's good for them. Don't think that's good for the world. But I think being interested in money and interested in financial stability, it is entirely compatible with also living a good life, right? I mean, what's your take on that?
I agree. Like, you need money in this world to do things, to have that financial freedom, to be able to make the decisions you want to make. For example, you could work in a company where you're not necessarily, you're working there to make money, but you're not, they're not necessarily facilitating your own faith. Having that financial freedom can allow you to practice your faith and live in this world. That's sort of the difference between, you know, not having the choice to practice your religion or your faith in the way you want to, if you don't have the financial freedom to do so. I think that's the big difference. And like we talk about like mortgage options, if you're living in New Zealand, if you have wealth, you can buy a property according to how you were allowed to. Whereas if you don't have, then you're kind of stuck with the options that are available. So you need that wealth. And that's sort of like the difference, I think, when it comes to wealth. It's just the mindset of how you're using it. And even in Islam, charity is a big part of our religion when it comes to that. As Muslims, we're required to pay 2.5% every single year on our net savings, so long as you've met a certain financial threshold. And that's a big part of our system where we're making money to feed back into the community, to grow the community. And that's sort of the idea of how we operate as well. And even just general donations are encouraged as well. So making money isn't just for ourselves, it's for our community at large. Just how, like, you know, we pay taxes so that the roads are better and, you know, you have free healthcare, things like that. That's sort of the mindset as well, where you make money to feed back into the community to better everyone. And that's sort of how I look at it as well when it comes to you need people to make money to flourish.
Yeah, it's really funny, isn't it? Because now that I'm a small business owner, I see tax much more than I did before. You know, you're an employee, you just sort of get your salary, you've already paid tax. You don't see it as much, it therefore doesn't sting as much. And it was quite funny because I offload the actual running of the numbers and the sending of the invoices to my husband. Good man. Does all that horrible stuff that I don't want to do. We were in the car just like talking about a couple of things with the business once, and he was grumbling about, he was like, my God, the amount of tax, it's so much money. And I was like, oh, do you not like this road that we're driving on? This isn't working out for you? You'd rather be off-roading it right now? Sorry, we're coming back from the doctors. We just took the kid to the doctors. Was that doctor no good? You went into that, you know? And I was being a little bit of a cheeky shit, as one does to one's husband. But, you know, at the same time, I totally agree with this perspective of you're part of a community. You need to give back to it. You need to be part of that community. There are things that we all benefit from there. I mean, it's interesting, isn't it, with the money thing. I think so much of this often starts quite early, whether or not we're realizing that we're starting on these journeys quite early. Do you remember, I mean, did your family ever talk about money growing up? Was this a conversation in your home? When did you start to get the bug for this and thinking, actually, I would like to integrate this into my life as part of my, you know, wider worldview?
Yeah, I mean, growing up, we definitely talked about money. So my dad was a businessman, grandfather businessman. It's always been like business in the family. So we knew things about money. We got our weekly savings. Didn't really talk much about investing. It was always like, save your money, start a business. And then like, if you want to buy a property, that's all sort of like later down the line. And that's sort of the mindset. I understood like the value of money, and that's sort of something that stayed with me. And like throughout the years, I started many like side hustles, you know, from like the age of 14 all the way to like, well, still going on some now, but I saw it and I realized it took a lot of my time to make money. I had to physically do something or sell something in order to make that money. And I was like, surely there's got to be a way for me to like just let my money do its thing and let it grow. I knew briefly of investing, but I had no idea about Islamic finance and like halal investing, things like that. There was very, very minimal education on it online. So I did research. Like, I made my first investment at the age of like 17. Fast forward a couple of years, and then I was really looking into it. And I was like, because I just graduated with a mechatronic engineering degree from Malaysia and moved to New Zealand and was struggling to get a job here. So my wife and I, we moved to Sydney for a year to just kind of reset, figure out what we wanted to do. in that time, I rediscovered my passion for investing. This was just pre-COVID. The stock market hadn't dropped just yet. And I was this is something I'm really passionate about, something I want to learn more about. Again, looked into it, Islamic Finance Online. There was only basically books, long form articles. And I was like, I think I was 22 or something at the time. I was like, I don't want to be doing this. I'm sure no 22-year-old wants to be looking through books on faith to find out how they can invest. Like, that's not exciting. So I kind of started Muslim Investing as just like on the side. And I was like, let me record all the information I'm learning and make it into like carousel posts that are easily digestible. And I started out like an anonymous account for like 6 months. Didn't tell my wife for a couple of months. Showed her and she was like, whoa, this is really cool. And that sort of grew out of there. And I grew my interest for Islamic finance. And it was just like documenting all the things I was learning as I was going along. And that's when like TikTok took off. So videos became, you know, way more popular. And I started creating like video, short videos. And over the past 5 years, it's gone from passion project to full-time gig. And it's just something I'm really passionate about, teaching Muslims about how to grow their wealth in a halal way, showing them what they can do, you know, what's possible, breaking down all the misconceptions. That's sort of what I love doing.
Yeah, yeah. And it is, I think, a real important bit of work to do there, because the information is out there, right? But knowing where to find it, having the time to get through it, versus going to where people already are and already are spending their time and giving it in little bite-sized chunks, you know, just a little tip here today, a little tip here tomorrow, so that people can take it in, water on a rock. They're just sort of generally slowly absorbing it. I mean, obviously, I do that from a very different perspective, but that's the reason why I've done the work the way that I've done, because I feel like breaking down these barriers is really important for people. Is that a similar thing that sort of attracted you?
Exactly. And yeah, it makes it a lot more doable. It is like, if you're not familiar with finance investing, it can seem really scary. And like, you're not sure where to start, how it works. But yeah, seeing short, bite-sized content, and that has resonated clearly with like my audience, because it's grown significantly over the last 5 years. So definitely people are interested in that sort of short, bite-sized content. And the feedback I've received over the years has been very positive. And they're like, this has been really helpful. They didn't know where to start. They came across one like reel or TikTok on their feed and they were like, I should probably be looking into this. Oh, I can make money. Oh, and I can do this. And like, oh, it's not so hard. And like, that's sort of what my goal is, to make it easy for everyone, because it is. Well, you just need the right information, and it can definitely be easy to get started. It's a journey when it comes to investing, I think, anyway. There's always things to learn in the space. But getting started is nowhere near as difficult as it used to be.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And starting small, starting from where you are, I say this until I'm blue in the face, just getting started is often the biggest thing, and realizing that actually it's not as scary as you might think. It can actually be wildly simple. But, you know, you mentioned there about, you know, being on the internet and how it can be really positive. Love to dive into that a bit more, because certainly the internet can be a little bit of a wild west sometimes. We are seeing some of these social media CEOs backing away from any moderation, so it's probably only going to be even more of a wild west soon. Do you find, when you're talking about these topics online, do you ever attract any hate or people who misunderstand what you're doing? Is there that side to things when you're having these conversations?
All the time. Literally with any topic. I think, like I mentioned, like things like criteria and things like that, and how certain things operate, like an Islamic mortgage, for example. And I'll be discussing it, or like in a video explaining how the concept works, and I'll get comments saying, did you come up with this yourself? Like, it doesn't make any sense. I'm like, I'm just passing on the information in a way that's digestible, but these are not things I've come up with. I'm not a scholar by any means. I don't claim to be. People really hate on me when I'm just like, I'm passing on the information to you. And again, if you're not happy with it, you don't have to like take it on board. Like, with no one's forced to invest, no one's forced to buy property. If you're not happy with that information, like, you know, feel free to not take it. Like, I'm just here to pass on information that I think will be beneficial for most people. And I think the goal is, even if you don't agree with it, it may get you thinking and start looking into it yourself. And then you'll find that, hey, actually, I can or can't do this. But there is definitely people who hate on the fact that they think, I've created these rules and I've created these criteria. And I'm just like, that's not the case. Like, I didn't come up with this. And like, I've got a couple of videos on Islamic mortgages. I think that's a very heated topic in the Islamic finance, but it's great for engagement.
As people yell at you in the comments, you're like, thank you so much for continuing to drive my engagement.
Basically, well, the proof is that I've got like two of my Islamic mortgage videos. I've got over 2 million views across those two videos. So definitely boosted the account. So was grateful for that aspect of it. But seeing the comments and the hate, and I'm just like, this is a problem. Like, there shouldn't be hate. Like, there should be discussion, and I want to have discussion. So I'm not, I try my best to just like not look at the negative comments, but engage with the ones that are constructive. And that, you know, to answer people's questions, if they genuinely believe, you know, this doesn't make sense. And I'm like, cool, how can I help explain that to you to sort of break down that barrier, as opposed to comments that are just saying, you don't know what you're talking about. Like, there's not much I can do with that. But if someone's like, hey, I don't understand this, and I'm like, okay, let me try and explain it to you. Or I can put you in the right direction of where you can learn more. And that's sort of what I do. But yeah, I get both the positive and negative. Positive outweighs the negative. So we're good on that front.
That's probably a very healthy way to deal with it. Yeah, I always try and figure out. Sometimes people are just having a bad day on the internet and then you turn up as a video on their feed and they just yell at you. And sometimes I look at something and I think, I feel like this comment isn't actually about me, so I'm just going to let it go. And then there are other times when someone's genuinely missed the point of it. And I'm like, oh, okay, let me just jump into the comments and have a little chat and we can explain things more. And that's fine. It's sometimes hard to have that healthy approach, but you do your best, right? So you find you certainly get pushback from people who maybe within the Muslim community who are saying, you know, don't tell me how to live my life, or you've got this point wrong or whatever. So that can cause controversy in your comment sections.
Basically, yeah. So like I mentioned earlier with the financial criteria, with like the 5% revenue threshold rule, people are like, did you come up with this with yourself? Where'd you get this from? Like, this makes no sense. How can you have 5% of interest? You know, like, it's all wrong. I'm like, I didn't come up with these things. These are from Islamic finance scholars. I can point you to the references, the resources. I'm just passing on that information, and you can take it up with them if you have an issue with it. Like, I didn't make these rules. I think that's what I get a lot. Like, people thinking I made up the rules, whereas I'm just passing on the information to the rest of us, you know, from what I found, from what I researched.
Yeah. Do you ever find any anti-Muslim sentiment in general, or are you lucky enough to avoid that?
I very, very rarely get that. Like, a few times with things, they're like, it's very, very rare, and not ones I can even remember, to be fair. A lot of times it's just like a straight block at that point. Like, I'm not going to even just engage with it. Like, there's no reason to.
Yeah, you're not exactly going to change their minds. So why bother?
Basically, like, I'm not, my content isn't for them, clearly. So like, there's no reason I need to engage with them.
Yeah. What do your family think, and friends and wife, I guess? What does the people in your life who are close to you, what do they think of you putting this information out there and having this really interesting, I mean, is this a side hustle? Is this a business? What stage are you at now?
So the past year and a half, it's become a full-time gig, which was an interesting, because I had to try and figure out how and what angle I wanted to sort of take it in terms of making it a full-time thing. That's been a bit of a journey. I'm still figuring that one out. In terms of my friends and family, wife, I think everyone's pretty supportive now. To be fair, I've got a significant following, so
success always helps.
It's a bit harder to be like, oh, I don't think what you're doing is making any sense when, you know, you've got, you know, a decent following. But no, my parents have definitely mentioned that they're proud of what I do. A wife certainly is, and it's cool because I get to speak to a lot of interesting people. And access like cool events and people in the industry and things like that, which I wouldn't have otherwise. By nature, I'm an introvert. So instead, I was like, let me create a massive following so people come to me so I don't have to talk to them. That's what I've done essentially. As opposed to going out to meet new people, I get invited and then they ask me the questions. So it's cool. And I think everyone finds it pretty interesting what I do.
Yeah. I personally love it. I mean, if there are, you know, people like myself who aren't Muslim, but find this area interesting. Do you think there's anything that other people in that sort of position can learn from the Muslim approach to investing?
I think so. We talked about earlier about like fundamentals and things like that and how ethical investing can prove to be better long-term investments, at least from what I've seen anyway. And I think that is applicable to everyone. You know, you don't have to be Muslim or even faith-based. But yeah, I mean, even like things like avoiding weapons and, you know, alcohol industries, a lot of people like are in alignment with that. Like it's, they don't have to be a certain faith to not be, you know, wanting to give money to companies that make weapons, for example. And the ESG rise, I think, has definitely helped with that. So halal investing is applicable to everyone. It's not just for Muslims. If you're interested in socially responsible, ethical investments, halal investing could be a great place to look at. And the industry at large is growing, so there are more options available, even if you're not Muslim and you don't have to be. I mean, you've got companies in the Middle East, for example, and non-Muslims are investing in those investments. And like they've done much better than the conventional ones, at least in those places.
All right. Well, we are pretty much out of time. I have loved this conversation. I feel like I've learned so much and had my worldview expanded, which is my favorite kind of conversation to have. So if other people want to know more about you, follow your work, where are the best places to find you?
Yes, they can check me out on Instagram or TikTok at Muslim Investing, one word. And that's where most of my information will be. And you can, you know, happy to reach out and hopefully answer any questions if anyone has any.
Perfect. Thank you so much. That's Mohammed Lambert from Muslim Investing. And if you want to send me questions about this or anything else to do with money, you can also find me online, Francis Cook NZ, on Instagram, TikTok, Facebook, basically everywhere. Send me those questions. Let's get them answered in a future podcast episode. Don't forget to hit subscribe to Making Sense before you leave. And of course, you can also sign up to my newsletter if you'd like. That's the Money Memo. You can find that either linked in the show notes or it's also on my website, francescook.co.nz. Until next time, have a great day. Just a note before you go. This podcast can only give you general information about how things work in most cases. It's not individual financial advice. We're all different, so some of this might not apply to your specific situation. Take what works for you, ignore the rest. If you're after individual financial advice, a financial advisor is always the best bet.